From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just a couple of weeks ago when a presidential historian testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about past presidential abuses of power. For Timothy Naftali, history is an important guide. He was, to my ears, not just talking about the past, but offering a kind of warning for leaders in Washington about possible future abuses of power. It was not about any one person or one possible president. It was a warning of what could happen, especially in light of the Supreme Court's decision regarding presidential criminal immunity in the case of Trump v. U.S. Naftali shared examples that already detail how presidents can abuse power. In one case, President Lyndon Johnson misused the FBI against black Mississippians who challenged the seating of the all-white Mississippi Party at the 1964 convention. There were other examples, and Naftali is concerned that the Supreme Court's recent decision opens the door to other kinds of abuses. He testified, quote, "The president's ability to request investigations, whether of an individual's tax return, of their service jacket, to request a name check against FBI records to inquire into their religious faith. It seems limitless," end quote. He concluded with, again, to my ear, a kind of warning, saying, quote, "The question arises, who or what protects the public from the president," end quote. Naftali told the Senate that Congress has become the last line of defense against presidential abuse of power. And he said that we would be naive not to assume it will happen again. I've been thinking about this kind of power a lot lately, and it seems to me that a growing number of Americans, well, they're fine with a single person holding enormous power, as long as it's their person, wielding power against people they don't like. How did we get to that point? How did we lose sight of the bedrock necessity of preventing a lurch towards something that looks more autocratic? Why are we celebrating concentrations of power? Naftali is visiting Rochester this week as a guest of the World Affairs Council's local chapter. He's a professor of public service at New York University. He's written a number of books, two of them co-authored with Alexander Forsenko on the Cuban Missile Crisis and Nikita Khrushchev, regular CNN contributor. I could do the resume probably all day, but he is generous with his time, and we're going to get right to it with Timothy Naftali. Tim, thank you for being here. It's great pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be with you, Evan.
What was your hope to accomplish when you testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee last month?
Well, your listeners, and they didn't know it at the time, kindly gave me the finest education in presidential abuse of power possible. I was the first federal director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum, which is a part of the National Archives. Therefore, I was a civil servant. And my job was to turn what had been a private space run by the Nixon family and the Nixon estate into a public space, by the way, at the request of the Nixon family and estate. They went to Congress and wanted this to happen. And so I because it was a public space, it needed to be a nonpartisan space. And a nonpartisan space that had in its museum a depiction of Watergate that was accurate. We also had in our vaults materials, which as a result of legal challenges in years before I was there, were not available to the public. And also as part of this transfer of authority, an agreement was reached between the Nixon interests and the U.S. government, which allowed more material to be released. So between 2007 and 2011, my job was to get that material out and to revise the public history about Watergate in a building with Richard Nixon's name over the top of it. So that's how I came to understand and to have a granular understanding of how presidents could abuse power. And when I was invited by the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm not a lawyer, but to comment on the implications of the Supreme Court's decision, 6-3 decision in Trump versus the United States, I responded with case studies about how presidents not named Trump had abused power, because what I wanted to make clear was that this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue the framers understood for us. They didn't know what we would look like. They didn't know what the country would look like. They certainly didn't anticipate 50 states. But what they did understand was that when you concentrate power in one pair of hands, and if those hands don't belong to George Washington, there is a threat, the possible threat to the country. So they created a system by which you could remove a president in office. It's the impeachment process. It's really impeachment and removal. And they also made clear that presidents that committed crimes while they were president could be tried by regular courts once they left office. So they understood the possibility of abuse. The problem is they didn't anticipate the size of the federal government. They did not anticipate that the United States would become a military power. They did not anticipate an FBI. There was no Justice Department until the late 19th century. They didn't anticipate a CIA. None of that. So they didn't recognize the enormous power that a future George Washington 5.0 would have. So they didn't catch the areas where presidents could abuse Americans, violate their civil rights without any trace. They didn't anticipate it. Well, we have those traces because presidents documented their activities. Not all of them taped. Many did, but not all. So we can actually study how presidents go about abusing or harming us. And I wanted to lay out for Congress these pathways so they could think in it in advance of ways to check that power when future presidents take advantage of the criminal immunity that the Roberts Court has given them for the moment.
Let me also just detour and say that I've seen you on a number of occasions talk about the need to declassify or to promise to declassify, even if it's 100 years in the future, mm-hmm. and the value that that has for our country and for the citizens who vote for these leaders who might abuse power. Why does it matter to promise to declassify?
Well, first of all, I worry a lot about conspiracy thinking. It's poisonous. It's corrosive in a country. I say this not seeking to put a check on it because I think there's nothing more important than freedom of expression. What I want is better education, better curation. And I want people to be their own curators, to be able to be skeptical, to ask questions. I always find amusing, and I mean it, I'm smiling at the moment, that most Americans think their federal government is inefficient, and often it is, but then they think the federal government is capable of these grandiose plots, whether you go back to Pearl Harbor or you go to 9/11 or you go afterwards. And so that this federal government that we think is inefficient and misusing our tax money is still capable of these really remarkable Hollywood plots.
That span years and probably thousands of people who never divulge.
There are no deathbed confessions.
Nobody ever divulges. No, yeah.
So, but I do worry that conspiracy thinking is a product of mistrust. And there is, if I may, since you asked the question, I think there's a difference between healthy skepticism and unhealthy mistrust. We have never been completely trustful of government in our country. That's a good thing. That's okay. The framers weren't, and that's why they set up a separation. They set up a system designed to check power. But at a certain point, this metastasized into the poisonous mistrust of institutions that we have now. And I can tell you when it happened, not the day it happened, but the era. And I can do that by looking. There are these, I think it's either the Gallup poll or the Pew poll, produced these trust in government surveys over time. And in the 1950s and 60s, early 60s, presidents, when the American people were asked, do you trust the president? presidents gave that, I mean, the Americans gave that president 65% trust. Now, if you think about it, that meant that people who didn't vote for that president trusted them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important concept. What happens after Vietnam and Watergate is that people stop trusting the president they didn't vote for, because you can correlate trust. If you disaggregate trust and look at party, Republicans trust Republican presidents and mistrust Democratic presidents and vice versa. So what happens is we go from a healthy trust mistrust based on performance of president and a sense of external threat to an unhealthy one that is correlated completely to party, because some parties' nominees aren't good. It just happens. The process produces a second-tier person. And if they get elected, they're not really going to be good as president. But they get support from people who voted for them, even though they're actually not performing well, and vice versa. When you lose the capacity to step aside outside of your team spirit, if you will, I could also use the term tribalism, then you lose the ability, I think, to assess in the extent to which your government is serving your interests. Because what happens if you have a president you didn't vote for and the economy improves? And, you know, your 401ks do better. Your salary goes up. Are you going to give that person credit? Or they manage some foreign policy challenge in an effective way. Are you going to give that person credit even though you didn't vote for them? 45 years ago, you would have. But now you won't. Because, well, I didn't vote for them. They're not part of it. And that's our problem. And so that has led to rampant conspiracy thinking, because people are trying to figure out realities that they didn't want. And so they can't think about it in the way they used to. They have to find some kind of secret explanation. And one way of combating that is by more transparency in government, so people see how government does and did what it did. Now, the intelligence community, understandably, requires the ability to protect sources. I'll give you two really good examples. One is that historically, the United States, like all great powers, has been able to break into the messages of foreign countries. It's more complicated now than it used to be, but it would involve learning their codes and ciphers. And that kind of knowledge can protect lives. If the Germans in World War II had known that we were reading all of their high-level military communications, they would have changed them on a dime, because countries upgrade their communication security all the time, but they would have done it dramatically. And World War II probably would have ended in an Allied victory, but it might have taken another 3 years and many more people would have died. So that's a secret that had to be kept. There are agents that work on behalf of countries, and sometimes those agents provide extraordinarily valuable information. Like a Soviet agent named Oleg Penkovsky during the Berlin crisis of 1961 and the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Protecting those agents and their families is a high priority. The question is, how long does that protection have to continue? And I think it's healthy in a society if you know that at a certain point, everything will be released. That certain point could be 75 years from now. But why does it make a difference? Because you don't want the powerful to believe that certain things won't be released, because it means that their future legacy requires good behavior. I believe human beings are, we're complicated things. There's goodness in us and there's greed and there are all kinds, and we're complicated. And there's nothing wrong with there being a check on power that involves the fact that you do something bad, we'll find out about it. So just don't do it in the first place. And you might say, well, 75 years, they're going to be dead. But their families will be around.
And their legacy
will be around. And so it's for the future of their families. By the way, when I say 75 years, I'm talking about national security, sources and methods. I'm not talking about political stuff. That should come out in 30 years or even earlier.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm a fervent believer in a promise of declassification, because it's a way of saying to the public, you are ultimately going to find out. And therefore, it ultimately has to be something you will ethically and morally be comfortable with.
So that's a great place to talk about solutions and why there may be a limit to this particular solution. talking to Timothy Naftali, who is in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council's local chapter, and we are grateful for his time here as a historian, professor, and author. It's a long resume. He testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee just a couple of weeks ago. And what you're describing is a really hopeful kind of solution that seems to be applicable to all but one of the current candidates for office. And I want to preface this by saying that Tim said before the hour, we can talk about anything you want. But he's also very clear that this is not about one person. His career's work has not been about warning against or being partisan. I mean, it's looking at the totality of what kind of abuses are possible. And they are not, as we mentioned with Lyndon Johnson, is just one example. They are not part and parcel to one party only. However, before the program began, you framed this in a way that I had never really thought about, but I think I will not ever forget, which is that if you look at, take Nixon, a very flawed human being, but now that we know a lot more about him, we can at least say that he had something that Donald Trump does not seem to have. And I want you to talk about this.
Sure. I'm happy to talk about Donald Trump. One of the things that I want to share with as many people as I can is that my concern about Donald Trump is not about Donald Trump. It's about what his approach to power represents. The president of the United States has three functions, which makes him and maybe someday her almost unique in the world. Unique in the democratic world, not unique in dictatorships, but unique in the democratic world. The president of the United States is commander-in-chief, head of government, and our head of state. Those are very different things. And if you misbehave on the international scene and are ungracious and uncivil and nasty,
boorish,
you tarnish the head of state responsibility, because that means we're all children. We're just impatient, childish, narcissistic children. And frankly, there are 40 million of us. Yeah, most of them are well-behaved, thoughtful, considerate people. Okay, but that's a matter of style, right? Then there's the issue of head of government. And even someone like Ronald Reagan, who believed that, government was the problem, not the solution, wanted to make government more efficient. He wanted it to work. He learned about it. In fact, he wrote about it before he was, in government and thought about it. He wanted it to work. He wanted it also to be the best representative. He wanted it to be smaller, but the best representative it could be of the American people. And he took it seriously, and he did his homework. And then as commander-in-chief, you want a commander-in-chief who respects the military, who understands that at times the country needs the military. Doesn't want it to, but it needs it at times to make the greatest sacrifice. Doesn't want it to. Nobody wants that. And that you hold that dear. So you want someone in that office who is a serious person, because these are serious responsibilities. These responsibilities didn't start in 2016. They've been part of the requirement of being president of the United States. Now, Richard Nixon, because you asked me about Richard Nixon, spent his life wanting those three responsibilities and studying them, learning about them. Now, he had darkness in his soul. He was an anti-Semite. He was a racist. He had a chip on his shoulder. But what he had that Donald Trump doesn't have is he had a sense of shame. He was his mother's son. His mother was a devout Quaker. And even though he could not meet her expectations, he's very honest about this in his very last major public speech at the end of his presidency, when he breaks down talking about his mother, because he had failed her. So in a sense, the Nixon story is a Shakespearean story. But he had a limit beyond which he wouldn't go. And that's from a sense of shame and a sense of responsibility. You know, he lost a Supreme Court case. He had tried desperately to keep the most damaging tapes out of the public sphere. He had taped, assuming, rightly, by the way, that the tapes were his private property. They were. At the time, the tradition was that presidents owned their papers and materials, which would include tapes. His predecessors, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, even Franklin Roosevelt, they had tapes. They owned those tapes, or their estates did. So he assumed he could pick and choose what the public heard, and he knew that the batch of tapes that the special prosecutor by that point, named Leon Jaworski, had asked for would really end his presidency. So he fought that, and he lost. But one of the things about our Constitution is nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the president of the United States has to obey the Supreme Court. It doesn't say that. These are three co-equal branches. It doesn't say that. He could have said no. He could have. In fact, his predecessor, long time before, Andrew Jackson, believed that the president and the Supreme Court were co-equal adjudicators of the Constitution. He could have done that. There's nothing written down that he had to follow the Supreme Court. He was shocked that the Supreme Court, many of whose members he had actually appointed, unanimously ruled against him. And it took him a few hours in the summer of 1974 to decide what to do. Sadly, the taping system was gone by then, and he didn't take notes that we've ever found. So we don't know exactly how close he came to not following the Supreme Court. Let me tell you all that our country's constitution was on a knife edge that day. Because what if he had said no? But he didn't. He said yes. He realized that for the sake of the country, he had to obey the Supreme Court. Now, it helped that he had actually pled. He's the only president ever to have pled before the Supreme Court. He had done that in a period. He was a private citizen for a few years between his run for the between his vice presidency and becoming president in 1969. So he said, and he respected the Supreme Court. He didn't have to, but he did. He had a sense of limits. He also had a sense of legacy. He also felt that his public career was over. He didn't intend to run again. He couldn't. So Nixon was held back by his own understanding of the presidency and his own sense of shame if he would in any way tarnish the presidency. My concern is when we elect people to the office who don't care about the office. Our greatest presidents have seen the office as bigger than them. Our worst presidents are those who've tried to make the office look like them. We expect our presidents to be better than us because they are our representative. As I said, they have these three huge responsibilities. So the case I was making about abuse of power was forget about Trump. If he is elected, he's elected. He's gone in 4 years. The question is, what does that do to the institution of the presidency and to the other branches of our government if we have an imperial president who effectively harms their enemies? Will that not build a desire for revenge and retribution by the next president? In which case we could be setting forward, we could be setting off a horrible cycle of abuse. This president against his or her enemies, this president against his or her enemies, making us a corrupt country with weak institutions except for the White House.
This is a moment in the program for me to remind listeners we're talking to Dr. Timothy Neftali, who is a historian. He's got a long resume. He's an outstanding guest, and the World Affairs Council just brings the most remarkable people. They really do. I'm thinking about a number of different things here. I'm going to recall this idea of shame, though, because I don't know if we could point to any other previous American president as being devoid of shame. I think Trump is the only one, and I think there's a dramatic risk of that. Now, 5 years ago, in an interview that you did with journalist Douglas Blackman, you said that one of the fundamental questions with Trump was this: when you have a thin-skinned, immature, mentally troubled person who becomes president, I think I'm trying to quote you as best I can, how well does the system protect the population against that person? And it seems to me that the first Trump term, which we were in at the time when you gave that interview, did offer some protections because it's pretty well documented. Trump didn't assume he would win. He went into office surrounded by people who did respect institutions, and they saw pretty quickly how dangerous he could be. Tillerson, Mattis, Esper, Kelly, the list goes on. And it seems that a second Trump term would offer no such insulation.
Well, that is certainly what the president of the putative future president of the United States is warning us about. The way, you know, I'm not engaging in any alarmist speaking. I could just be quoting President Trump on the hustings and the campaign trail. He's promised to use power more effectively the next time. I want to talk about Nixon for a moment.
Yeah.
Because getting into the weeds about Nixon, I think, will set the stage for why I hope the American people will think hard about what kind of character they want to have in the Oval Office. Because I'm going to talk about an imperfect restraining system for Nixon. Nixon had this conspiratorial fear of Jewish people. And in moments of fear, in his case, he would fantasize about the existence of a Jewish conspiracy. You can hear it on the tapes. And in the summer of 1971, after Daniel Ellsberg leaks the Pentagon Papers, Nixon becomes convinced that he is facing a Jewish conspiracy. And so when, this is hard to believe, but I'm afraid, I shouldn't even, it's not funny, but it's like bizarre. When Nixon is not happy about how the Labor Department has announced the most recent unemployment figures, because there's an economist in the Labor Department who says that the 0.6% improvement, in other words, less unemployment, is the product of an anomaly. He wants to know who that economist was, because the economist is not mentioned, but the Washington Post, perhaps, or the Washington Star mentioned that an economist there said this. And he says, is it Goldstein? Because he's had his eye on this Jewish economist who he feels has been leaking things to undermine people's appreciation of the advances made by the administration on the economy. And he wants to know if it's that Jewish one. And he finds out that they can't actually prove it. So he says, I want that man. He's going to take a lie detector test. I want him polygraphed tomorrow. It's on the tapes. He's ordering that this obscure economist, because he's Jewish, be polygraphed. And then it doesn't happen because there are people that the Labor Department, they're not going to let this happen. This is not the CIA where you can be polygraphed regularly, they don't do that. So he gets angrier. And he says, I need to know how many are Jews in that area. And he asked for a list of every Jewish person in the U.S. government in a sensitive area. He orders this of his chief of staff. We know this because it's on tape. He says, you know, we can't trust these people. They're disloyal. And he goes on and he talks about Jews and he talks about how they're spies. That's part of their culture. And it's an outrage. I mean, for a moment when you're listening, you know, it's you're thinking you're listening to an English version of something, of a conversation that would have occurred in Berlin in the 1930s. He says he's not talking about killing these people, but he doesn't trust them and he wants them not to have power. So the system didn't work to protect those Jewish people completely because Nixon was surrounded by anti-Semites. So they knew that it would be disruptive to the U.S. government to have a list of every Jewish person. I mean it. He ordered that of every Jewish person in every sensitive area, every Jewish American. They thought it would be disruptive, but they didn't like Jews either. So the chief of staff, who was an anti-Semite, his name was Bob Haldeman, he says, well, let's do it somewhere. So they decide, well, let's do this list of Jews in that part of the Department of Labor that angered Nixon in the first place. And then Nixon says, well, let's fire them all just because they're Jewish and they're not trustworthy. Well, in our government, you cannot do that. Thank God. And civil service protections protected them. So the president was told, we can't fire them. But this is how the conversation went. Our tax dollars were being used in 1971 to determine whether you could fire people because they were Jewish. Now, that shows you the power of the president. The president should have lost his job at that point and been gone. Can you imagine? Just imagine if a president sat in the office and said, is that person evangelical? They didn't vote for me. Get rid of them. That's what Nixon was saying. And the whole system depended on the characters of those around him, because it meant you had to stand up and say no to a president, because our system doesn't work that way. In the executive branch, you can't say no to a president, but you can. But it takes work and effort. So what I was saying 5 years ago, having known the story of how Nixon's worst instincts were checked, but not always effectively and not always willingly, was that the whole system, because of the gray areas that allow presidents to do things that would be terrible, The whole system depends on advisors saying, let the president get some sleep. In the case of Nixon, it might be because he was drunk. Let him get over, because we have from the biography of his defense secretary, Mel Laird, during a hostage crisis in 1970, a group of some of our listeners, your listeners, Evan, might remember this. Before 9/11, there was a time when four planes were hijacked almost simultaneously. And it was in 1970, and it was the PFLP, a splinter group of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which did it. And they ended up, three of them ended up in Jordan at an old British airfield. And Nixon lost his patience with the process of negotiating for them to be released, and he ordered the U.S. to bomb and destroy the three planes, even though there were hostages on them. In the middle of the night, he calls up the defense secretary. Well, the defense secretary realized that he couldn't possibly do this and decided just not to do it. And the next morning, Nixon didn't mention it again, because either he was tipsy when he did it, or he was had taken a pill, or just something wrong. But Nixon wasn't terribly stable. So our system depends on people saying no to presidents, because the presidents are human beings. When you have a president who comes to office saying, I'm going to make sure that everyone around me is a yes man or yes woman, then who knows what terrible things could happen? Because we've seen in the past presidents being checked before they did horrible things. And in Nixon's case, he wasn't fully checked, which is why his presidency ended prematurely. But it's, if you study presidents, you realize some of them were great and were at the best. They were the pinnacle of what one would expect or hope as an American. But most of our presidents are extremely human. And that means they are flawed, which means they need to be checked every once in a while. And if you're surrounded by yes people, that doesn't happen. And it's dangerous for the Republic.
Donald Trump Jr. said recently loyalty tests will be one of the most important criteria for choosing hundreds or thousands of jobs in Washington in a new Trump administration. By the way, with Nixon, with his decision to follow, to obey the Supreme Court's decision, when you said the country was on a knife's edge, for all of the sort of the tarnishing of his legacy of history, shouldn't we appreciate that at least a little bit on the human scale?
Absolutely, which is why we're talking about it. In fact, we talked about that before we talked about the other. It's important to talk about all sides. I think Nixon is a very interesting example because he had this horrible side to him. And yet even Nixon, in the end, put the country first.
You've written books about the Cold War. I want to pivot just a little bit here with some of the remaining time here. About the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm of an age that I was never aware growing up of a threat of nuclear war. I didn't have any classroom drills. You know, it was not something that was in my consciousness, even as a child. And so in February of 2022, Russia invades Ukraine, and I felt that existential angst. And my father told me, now you're starting to understand. And I wonder, have you felt at any point since February of 2022 any of the same kind of anxiety about possible nuclear war, or does this feel different to you?
I have not felt anxiety about nuclear war.
I'm glad to hear that. Why?
Well, I had the privilege, I was just out of grad school, of taking advantage of that very short period when you could get access to Russian or Soviet records. I read Russian. And I wrote these two books with a Russian scholar who's no longer with us. He was 35 years older than me. And so I saw that the Russian capacity for bluff, not his capacity for bluff, not Alexander Forsenko's, but What I learned from delving deeply into Russian materials, including Russian intelligence materials, I read KGB records, KGB analyses for the leadership, that the Russians were afraid of us. And I saw how they countered their fear by bluff. And I also saw how they didn't understand us. Now, I don't necessarily think that's true anymore. The Soviet system was different, and they didn't train their analysts the way we do. Soviet analysis was very careful because of a fear that the party would shift its approach. So a lot of their analytical product, I'm talking about their intelligence community's analytical product, was contradictory. The same document would actually make different arguments. It's not because Russians weren't smart, but they are. It's that they lived in a polluted intellectual environment that did not reward clarity of thought. They had to be politically careful. Putin comes from that era, and so I suspect that the people around him provide him with that kind of analytical product. But if you look at how the Russian economy and Russian activities have developed, I don't know if young Russians live in that kind of mental universe, but Putin does. So I sort of thought, and this may be arrogant, I apologize, it's my understanding of Russia, I thought what I knew about the Soviet mindset was useful to understanding Putin and his generation and those around him. And those people are afraid of us. They admire us. They admire us. They're afraid of us, and they think they know us. And what they think they know about us is that we're timorous people, that we're easy to scare. The Russians figured out in the 50s how to scare us. I'll give you a couple of examples quickly. I know we don't have a lot of time. The Russians knew that we were afraid at the concept of being attacked. We had not been attacked. Our mainland had not been attacked since the British attacked us in 1812. Of course, Hawaii, 50th state, loved the place. That's my first job was there. I lived there for a bit. It was attacked in 41. But in terms of our continental United States, we hadn't been attacked since 1812. And the Russians thought, well, we're going to create this idea that we have these bombers that'll attack the United States. Well, they didn't, actually. Their bombers, yeah, could probably make it one way, but certainly couldn't return. So this was a suicide mission. The Soviets were not suicide bombers. Let me make clear. This is not Al-Qaeda. Number two, they didn't have as many as they wanted us to think they had. In that era, this is before we developed U-2 spy planes, let alone satellites. The way that you could determine how many bombers a country had was you would go to their bomber day or their national holiday, and they would have the bombers fly overhead. And so the Russians flew the same two bombers over and over again over the heads of people sitting in Red Square. And you had all these U.S. and British and Canadian military attachés, air attachés, counting them. Plus, the Russians played games with the serial numbers on planes so that you thought they had more. As a result, our intelligence community vastly exaggerated the number of bombers they had. Now, the Soviets thought that would contain us. Well, it didn't. What did we do? We built more bombers. And we built the capacity to count their bombers. We put up a U-2 spy plane, which their radars could pick up, and they realized, oh, my God, our bluff is gone.
They know. Yeah.
So then they bluffed with missiles. And that didn't work. So then they put missiles in Cuba. That what they wanted to do was to scare us, to contain us, because they knew that our power was greater than theirs. They never matched our economic power. They couldn't. But they also knew that technologically speaking, they had to steal from us to keep with us. That is the Russian mindset. So what Putin did, and you'll notice, he drew these red lines. You do this, and I'll And then you know what? We in NATO, we went above the red line.
We did the no, yes for every one of those.
And I felt we were self-deterred. I felt we could have done more for Ukraine. We handled it pretty well, but I thought we could have done way more. We could have given them missiles.
Sooner, yeah.
Yeah, because my intent. But again, if I, you know, I don't have any power, right? That's good, probably. But the thing is, if I were wrong, the cost would have been huge. And so our government was careful.
Absolutely.
But you asked me if I had existential. No, Russia, this is not the Cold War. They're not a superpower. They are a regional power. This is not existential for us. But Putin thinks he could play on that, and he actually did a little. At least the Ukrainians have long-range missiles, finally. And they have planes, finally.
Brief aside, because you have cataloged presidential abuses and scandals quite well. What do you make of the Bob Woodward's new book and the revelation that Donald Trump sent some of the very first COVID tests, not to his family, not to somebody he loved, but to Vladimir Putin himself, seven of them. And Putin told Trump, according to the book, and the Kremlin, by the way, yesterday confirmed this account. If you want to trust them.
Of course they would.
Yeah. They said, Putin told Trump, this better not get out because this won't be good for you publicly, but thank you for the tests. What do you make of this?
Okay.
Should this be a big deal?
Well, I don't know. You know, there used to be a time when Americans didn't like to be played. I mean, I don't know. I don't want my president to be played. Trump is a sucker. Imagine if you're so insecure, you need the validation of a foreign mass murderer. So, look, I don't know what to say. Of course it's outrageous. We were talking about the Cold War. Could you imagine John F. Kennedy, Dwight Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson, George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan— Needing a pat on the back from the Kremlin. Now, they dealt with the Kremlin because it's a smart thing to do. You've got the sword of Damocles. You've got nuclear holocaust hanging possibly in the air. You should talk to your adversary. Smart thing to do. Nixon talked to.
But that's different than
yes. When Nixon went to Mao, he didn't ask Mao to do a campaign commercial for him in the United States. You know, so this is the difference between being a serious commander-in-chief and being unserious. The thing about this period we're in is because of this poisonous political environment, a lot of Americans are not expecting the kind of behavior from their president that they used to. This wouldn't have flown. This wouldn't have. Nobody would have taken somebody who did this with Russia seriously in the Cold War. People would have run from it and said, oh, my gosh, we can't trust this guy. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that former President Trump is some kind of Manchurian candidate. I just don't think he's serious. I think he sees Trump. I think he sees Putin as a powerful, rich guy with a capital city that should have a Trump hotel or two. And he likes being around people that he's not. He wants to be around powerful, tough people.
He wants to be in the club.
And he isn't.
Yeah.
We know that he's a physical coward.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have to be a Manchurian candidate. He said it at a rally the other day. He said, maybe I shouldn't say this, but he said, I guess I have a personality flaw. I like people who like me. He's very easy to manipulate that way.
Well,
that's all. It's not complicated.
No, but I mean, imagine, we want our quarterbacks, right, to be tough and smart and to understand the field and to understand their adversary, but also to be able to shake hands at the end of the day. We expect a certain level of behavior from many of our local and national heroes. Unfortunately, we don't expect it from our president anymore, and that's a big change in our history.
All right, last minute or so. Dave says your guest should run for president or some kind of office. Your guest is great and a supreme intellect. You're going to run for office, Tim? Guess not.
Okay, no. Let me say, first of all, It's easy to talk this way when you're not running for office. And two, where am I from? I mean, in other words, I love politics. I did a lot of politics when I was a kid. I grew up in Montreal. I'm a U.S. citizen now. And one of the things I learned is that all politics is local. And you got to be from somewhere. I'm not the kid from Scranton. I'm the kid from Montreal. Last I looked, there is no congressional district from Montreal. So I want to be a really good and helpful American citizen and let other people run for office. And okay. If I can be helpful in my own little way with the few things I know, I'll be that way.
All right, music's going to play here. So in 15 seconds or less, are these solutions that you talked about, declassifying, are these things within reach?
Yes.
They are. We can become more transparent.
Oh, yes. I know it for a fact. Yes. We have to work harder. And we need a president who puts a little bit of effort into it. I'm not saying that they want to keep secrets, but you can move the intelligence community around. It just takes an effort, and it can only come from the White House.
I want to thank Dr. Timothy Naftali for joining us this hour. An invigorating, perhaps at times terrifying and elucidating hour. Thank you very much for your expertise.
My pleasure, Evan. Thank you for inviting me.
We've got more connections coming up in a moment.